Welcome back to The Fleet, the number one industry podcast for fleet managers and their teams. I'm your host, Albert Chow. We are psychologically incapable of putting down the phone. That might sound horrific, but Dr. Paul Atchley, a professor of psychology at University of South Florida, has studied human behavior for decades, and he's convinced distracted driving is going to be part of our everyday lives, that people want more entertainment and connectivity options while driving, and more importantly, we as a culture find it acceptable to exhibit these behaviors. So what can be done? On this episode of The Fleet, Paul educates us about distracted driving and the inside of our human brain. He explains why we behave the way we do and how to prevent distraction. He tells stories of international policies that are much more effective at preventing distracted driving accidents and how some cities and private companies are doing it too. All that and more on today's episode. Let's jump in. The Fleet is brought to you by our friends at Lytx. Whether you manage a fleet of 5 vehicles or 5,000, Lytx is here to help. Lytx fleet dash cams are powered by best-in-class machine vision and artificial intelligence, designed to help commercial fleets and drivers operate more safely, efficiently, and profitably with the industry's most comprehensive and customizable fleet management platform. Go to lytx.com/thefleet to learn more today. That's lytx.com/thefleet. Welcome, everyone, to another episode of The Fleet, and today we have Paul Atchley. Paul is a professor of psychology at the University of South Florida. Paul, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. I'm really looking forward to our conversation.
All right. So this show's The Fleet. We talk about road safety, logistics, the state of the industry, the future of fleet management, all kinds of things. So why did we invite a professor? Tell our audience, what is your specialty?
So for the past, well, over 30 years, I guess I'm dating myself, I've been studying how we use our brains to move around our environment. I originally started working with helicopter pilots to understand how they use their perceptual and cognitive systems to control helicopters. And when I got my PhD, I started focusing on driving, first with older drivers, and then later looking at the issue of distracted driving in more detail. So I've been working in the area of distracted driving for over 2 decades now, both understanding how the brain impacts distraction and distracted driving, as well as how company policies can either help or hinder the safety of the employees related to the same thing, distracted driving.
Yeah, and we want to dive into both aspects, the brain and company policy. But before we do that, I'm curious, what got you into this field? Because you were doing, it sounds like you said, helicopters, aviation. What was it about motor vehicles that got you interested or that you were fascinated by?
I'm a native Californian. I did my PhD in California, and for my dissertation, I was studying older drivers, you know, Southern California, right? So what do? You live on the freeway. So I've always been interested in issues of driving, but I started from that older driver perspective to really understand why it was that drivers who were the safest when you're in your 50s and early 60s, slowly but surely, on average, became the least safe drivers on the road.
Really?
Or actually second least safe next to the youngest drivers, I should say. And so really trying to understand how the brain changes and how that those changes affect the ability to perceive and understand the roadway and react appropriately. Right around, I'd say the late 90s, we started to see crashes that look like older driver crashes. Mm. Older drivers have a particular crash that they're most at risk for, failure to yield right of way, where they will go into an intersection when it's not their turn, or when they just won't notice when someone else has the right of way pulling out of a driveway or something. Those crashes are actually on average pretty infrequent in let's say people in their 30s to their 50s. But for whatever reason, as drivers get older, those start to increase to almost account for about half of the crashes. Turns out it's because not their eyes are going bad, but because their attention is becoming more limited. Mm. So as you're driving around, you have to pay attention to what's going on in the periphery, right? Well, we started to see these failure of attention crashes in, 20 and 30 and 40 year old adults who, by all rights, should be good drivers. And what we discovered was that many of them were distracted by a phone and having a conversation. So I started to really try to got really interested in why a conversation, which seems so simple, would tax your brain so much that you would suddenly look like a 75-year-old adult with Alzheimer's disease while you're driving.
You know, that's super fascinating because you were talking about how accidents tend to be concentrated almost like in a barbell effect, right? It happens when we're earlier and you said it happens when we're later. And you also said it's the crashes, there's a certain type of crash in each age range. Now it's bleeding into, now it makes sense that if we aren't distracted, we would be more like an older driver. But what is it specifically about being distracted that causes this type of accident? Is it because we're not paying enough attention processing, let's say, speeds? Because I know when I want to make a left turn, I have to kind of judge the vehicle in front of me and be like, okay, well, how fast is it coming to me? Do I have enough time? And I've noticed, you know, certainly people are more aggressive making that dash. Some people are more conservative. You know, everyone slower than you is an idiot. Everyone faster than you is an animal. What is it about that, like you said, pulling into an intersection? What is it about this? What's the science behind the distraction that makes it more prevalent or more likely to occur? Like, is it the calculations? Is the risk levels go down because you can't calculate things? I'd love to hear the reasoning for that.
Yeah. There are a couple of researchers that I really respect and are friends, Don Fisher and David Strayer, and they've come up with a model called SPIDER. And I think it's a really good way for anyone to think about how complicated it is to drive. So SPIDER stands for sensing, perceiving, interpreting, deciding, and executing a response.
Okay.
So as you're driving down the road, first thing that has to happen is you have to sense the environment, which means your eyes, so I'm not talking about your brain yet, your eyes have to be able to detect the information. So if it's foggy, you're not able to sense much because it's visually limited, right? So once your eyes are able to sense what's out there, you then have to perceive it. There's a difference between your eyes detecting it and your brain able to perceive it, and then I interpret it. So that first, those first three letters, SPI, really talks about the basics for any drive is that you have to be able to see it, be able to understand what it is and interpret what that object's doing. So to give an example, you're driving down a road in a residential neighborhood. You sense motion by the sidewalk. So your eyes turn to the right. You perceive a child that is chasing a ball into the street, mm-hmm. and you interpret that as an object that might enter your pathway.
Yeah.
So that's the first three building blocks. And so when we think about distraction, and we're going to talk about distractions broadly in three categories, cognitive, visual, and manual. When we think about distractions, if you're visually distracted, as an example, so you're texting and you're looking down at your phone, that means you can't sense, perceive, or interpret because you're not actually detecting that motion, seeing that it's a kid and understanding that it's in the roadway in front of you. That's one way in which a distraction from a device or even turning and looking in the backseat, talking to your own kids, can prevent that first set of critical actions. But let's say that the individual is able to sense, perceive, and interpret. And now they know that there's a kid running into the street. Now we get into those second three letters, deciding and ER, executing a response. So when you know what's happening, you then have to come up with, your brain has to come up with a set of possible things that it can do to avoid the child, avoid the crash. And this is actually where the brain is probably the most limited. This is where we see some what we call bottlenecks. Because your brain will come up with multiple options. It might say brake. It might say turn right, turn to the left, you know, into oncoming traffic. It can give you a number of different options. And then the last thing is you have to actually, once your brain's picked one, execute a response. Either slam on the brakes, jerk the steering wheel to the right, jerk the steering wheel to the left. So when we think about the task of driving, it's really complicated because you have to figure out what's going on around you, which means you have to be completely present. You can't have your eyes off the roadway. That takes away sensing, perceiving. You can't have your hands off the wheel because it's going to take away your ability to turn the wheel, right? And that's going to get away from executing your response. But the most important thing, and this goes back to the beginning, we talked about younger drivers and older drivers and the way in which they sometimes fail, is if your brain is not fully on the task, if you are cognitively distracted, you're having a conversation with someone on a cell phone hands-free, That slows down the ability of your brain to sense, perceive, and understand, interpret what you're seeing. Slows down your ability to create options. It slows down that decision-making process and slows down your ability to execute a response. And that's why when we were looking at drivers who were on a phone talking, this is back in the day for smartphones, right? It was just a phone.
Yeah.
When their brain was on that conversational task, they suddenly looked inattentive, like an older adult with Alzheimer's disease or dementia, because their brain was just slowed down by that conversation and they were unable to do all those important components and avoid the child, which would have been a failure to yield right of way crash.
So how bad does it get? You know, you mentioned, because like for someone, you know, what's the reaction time reduction by? Because like I've seen some like stats of, hey, it takes an extra X amount of time, which yields this much space, distance if you're traveling this many miles per hour.
Right.
I'm curious. Has that changed? I mean, are people getting better at it? I'm curious because there's...
There's a couple of questions. Let me do them one at a time. I'll do the second one first. People are not getting better.
Yeah.
We've had the same brain for, you know, hundreds of thousands of years. It's not improved because we've been practicing technology in the last 3 or 4 decades, or even since you were 2 years old playing with an iPhone. In fact, military of the United States, Russia, Japan, Israel, probably some other countries have spent billions of dollars trying to get folks like me to train fighter pilots to do some of these tasks more effectively. And the bottom line is you can't increase capacity for some of these things much. There's a couple things you can do, but there's not much flexibility there. The first part you talked about, you know, how slow does it make you?
Yeah.
So there's a concept in the crash literature, the driving literature, called perception reaction time. If you ever work on a crash case, you'll hear attorneys use this term perception reaction time, where crash reconstructionists will say, well, average perception reaction time is 1 to 2.5 seconds. And so given the speed they're traveling and the distance, it was within perception reaction time for them to hit the brakes, or it wasn't and they couldn't do it. So that perception reaction time is one way of kind of describing all that stuff I talked about in the spider model, right? You know, sense, perceive, understand, or interpret, create a set of possible responses, decide, and then execute a response. That's, you know, perception reaction time. We've actually, when we first did our research looking and comparing older adults to people on a cell phone, what we did was we utilized a task called the useful field of view task. It's a task designed to measure the essentially attentional capacity, or in a sense, perception reaction time of older adults. It's actually used by countries like Australia to screen older drivers from the road. If you take it and you get a certain score, that sends you to a gerontologist, and then you can have your license taken away. You can take scores on that task, and you can actually then judge what the percentage likelihood there is that someone will be in a crash over time. It works really well, particularly for those failure to yield right of way crashes I was talking about. We gave that task to 20-year-old college students who look like fighter pilots, frankly, in terms of their perception reaction time, and had them engage in a hands-free conversational task, a really simple one. I would give them a word like microphone, and they'd have to give me a word back that started with the last letter of the word microphone. So they'd have to say egret, and I'd say wall, and they'd have to say loon, you know, whatever. They would just give me, it was just a simple back and forth. They'd have to listen for comprehension and generate a simple response. Not as complicated as a lot of conversations, particularly emotional ones. We gave those younger drivers, very attentive younger drivers, that task. Their attention looked like the attention of a fighter pilot, and it suddenly was an attentional profile of a 75-year-old adult with Alzheimer's disease. Their perception reaction time at a minimum was quadrupling.
Quadruple
at a minimum. And we gave them things like emotional conversations or conversations with people that they cared about, like within their social circle. So the conversation was really important to them. It could go up as much as 10, 12, 17 times. So if you're like really involved in that conversation, your brain's just on the conversation.
Yeah.
And it locks your brain up. You can't process what you're saying. So let's just say best case scenario, it's slowing you down by fourfold, and that's bad.
Yeah, and on the low end, it's 17 times. 17 times slower reaction.
High end.
Oh, high end, excuse me. Yeah.
Yeah, low end. Yeah. Low end isn't bad. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that's pretty horrific. Now, just so everyone's clear, you are talking about conversations.
Right.
What about what is the new bane of every motorist out there, which we all are, you know, we hate everyone for texting, yet I think too many people text.
Right.
What about texting? Are the numbers different for texting? I'm sure they are, but I'm curious.
Yeah. Great question. So let's go back to that concept I introduced, which are the types of distractions: manual, visual, and cognitive. Manual means your hands aren't available fully to control the vehicle. You're doing something with them. You're eating a burger. You're touching your phone. You're playing with the stereo. Visual means your eyes are taken away from the roadway, so that SPI, you know, sensing, perceiving, interpreting is slow or absent because you're not actually seeing what's out there. And then cognitive, where your brain is engaged, and cognitive actually reduces your ability to manually control things, but it definitely reduces your ability to scan the environment effectively and then understand what you're seeing and then make decisions and execute. Texting and things like texting, so things like, you know, checking social media and doing other kinds of things, requires your hands. So manual distraction. Requires your eyes, visual distraction. In fact, on average, you're taking your eyes off the road during a text about 4 or 4.5 seconds. And definitely requires your brain. So there's a cognitive distraction. It's really the unholy trinity of distractions. So when you talk about something like texting, that produces even greater increases. We haven't measured it using that same task we were talking about. It just wouldn't work. We would, the task would time out for us. We wouldn't be able to use texting with that useful field of view task I was mentioning. But when you have all three of those things as a distraction, your ability to drive is significantly impaired.
No, super fascinating. Talk to me a little bit, because you kind of laid out why, what happens to our brains when it's distracted, whether it's through cognitive or, like you said, through texting, where now every element of my being is now distracted, right? My eyes are distracted, my hands are distracted, everything's distracted.
Right.
I'm curious to hear your opinion. How does this begin to stop? Because here's what's interesting that I've noticed and observed. Number one, cell phone prevalence ain't going away. Like, that is here to stay. People are going to have cell phones.
Right.
But the more interesting thing I've started noticing is that the automakers themselves are kind of bringing the cell phone to the car, because they started realizing that people really want touch systems, hands-free systems. So, like, I mean, people are like talking to their cars now to turn on air conditioning. I mean, if I were to look at a Tesla, it's got no knobs. It's got no knobs. You have to look at, in my opinion, you have to look at the screen to see what you're doing.
Right.
Just to, like, let's say, improve your line of sight on your rear view mirror, because the control's no longer, or it's no longer a hand thing you just fidget with. It's, you got to get to the menu. You got to get to your mirror. You got to, like, touch it up, touch it down, touch it left, touch it right. Everything's becoming extremely touch oriented. They want you to use these systems. And this is at the auto manufacturer level. What do you think that's, I'd love to hear your opinion on that. What do you think is going to happen because of this?
And this is just my opinion, but it's based upon actually talking to some OEMs who will tell you off the record. You know, these are systems that are used to differentiate cars, you know, the infotainment systems. The original data did not suggest consumers necessarily wanted these things, but think about it. You know, what was used to sell minivans 20 years ago? The cup holder. That became a big point of distinction, literally.
Yeah.
It helped. I forget that. I think it was a Chrysler product. It really helped propel that car. And suddenly there was a proliferation of cup holders. So these systems originally were used to really sell the cars and to really get consumers looking at that as a feature that made that car special. But now it's become normalized. I think it sends a message personally that these systems are safe when they're not. In fact, we've done that research. We published that research, so I can say based on science. When we talk to consumers, they tell us that, well, this must be safe because it's in a car.
Yeah.
It must be tested. It must be regulated by the government. And the bottom line answer is, no, it's not. So
it's like validation. It's right. Almost like validation. Oh,
can't sell it if it's not, if it's dangerous. But you use Tesla as an example. You know, I want to pick on Tesla, but I think it's a particularly good example. You know, Tesla sells a car in which they're beta testing driverless features. And I think the news has been pretty clear that there have been a number of crashes where, you know, that particular feature did not perform in the way in which people thought it would. And even though they were supposed to continue to be in the control loop, they were not. And so there were crashes that occurred. That system is being tested as we speak on the roadway.
Yeah.
It's not being regulated by the government prior to actually going out for those kinds of tests. So I think consumers have to be very aware that the systems that they're buying aren't necessarily given the Consumer Reports stamp of approval or the Better Housekeeping stamp of approval for safety. Now, there are organizations like the AAA Foundation for Traffic Safety that have done some work. You know, this is work done by David Strayer and Joel Cooper to actually measure the workload created by the different infotainment systems in different vehicles and kind of come up with a scale to say, you know, this system seems for the system pretty good. This system is really complicated and it's a lot of mental workload. So there are some efforts out there to try to do that. But the bottom line is, you know, we've got cars now where the systems aren't necessarily regulated in some way for safety, and consumers have to be aware that just because they can do it, it doesn't mean that anyone's determined that it's safe to do it.
So, you know, I'm curious what you think about the future of driving, because we've read some articles by you, some really interesting predictions. We want to dive into a couple of those. But, you know, earlier you talked about there's two things that happen, right? There's the actual, the brain, the science behind our brains and why distracted driving occurs. And then you also talked about company policy and like how that is actually what, obviously it's much harder for, I mean, let's just face it, it's harder for laws to as much as it impacts a lot of people, it also there's a lot of people that don't follow the law. I mean, the speed limit, mild suggestion. I think we all agree to that. I've seen plenty of people not care or worry about seatbelts. You already know that some states don't allow for, you know, don't require helmets for motorcycle riding. So
right.
The laws can only go so far. Whereas company policy can easily, in my opinion, maybe not easily, but have almost a greater impact on behavior than laws do, which is interesting.
No, you're absolutely right. In fact, there's a really great example of that. If you look at seatbelt safety, seatbelt laws, I forget when the first seatbelt laws came online, but you know, 50s, 60s, I think. It really wasn't until companies who had fleets started to require that their drivers, people that were driving in a company vehicle of some kind, wore a seatbelt that you started to see an adoption rate increase it for seatbelts. Now, that didn't do everything. It wasn't until laws went into place to then require seatbelts that you saw the big push to the mid-80s and low 90s, depending on the state. And even now, for seatbelts, the percentage of people in the state that wear a seatbelt is a function of whether or not it's a primary or secondary enforcement of that law. Primary meaning you can get pulled over for not wearing a seatbelt. Secondary meaning you can't get pulled over for it, but if the trooper sees you not wearing it and they pull you over for something else, they can give you a ticket in addition for not wearing a seatbelt. If you look at National Highway Transportation Safety Administration data for seatbelt usage in states, the percentage in that state depends on primary or second enforcement. Bottom line, though, the companies had a really big effect on the willingness of people to wear seatbelts early on, and then those laws just kind of reinforce that over the long term. Companies will have a really big role to play with regard to distracted driving, because there does not seem to be a willingness amongst legislatures to put in full distraction bans in the United States, unlike the way other countries have done it. So I think it's going to be up to companies to really fill that in.
Yeah, it's pretty fascinating from state to state. Even in our country, the laws for mobile phones are different. In some, you can Bluetooth only. Some, of course, don't seem to have laws. I don't know.
Right, that's true.
Yeah, is that correct? Some states have no regulation whatsoever on cell phone usage. Is that accurate?
I haven't done. It's been a couple of years since I've looked at the list. Last time I looked, there were still some states that didn't have anything on the books. Yes, that might have changed, but
pretty fascinating.
Yeah, I'll give you an example. I testified to the Kansas legislature on the necessity for distracted driving laws. And at the very beginning of the hearing, there was a legislator. He said, I'd like to make a statement. I do not believe that we should legislate safety, period, full stop. I'm like, okay. Well, and I didn't say anything to that, I don't recall. But you know, when that's the attitude, you shouldn't legislate safety, then of course you're not going to put laws on the books. Other people might have a different opinion.
Yeah, then why have building codes? Why have... I mean, it's insane.
Right. You had building codes because people died in fires in horrible ways, and people got together and decided that they didn't want to do it anymore. You've got distracted or drunk driving laws because you had some really high profile cases of people dying to drunk drivers. But that's an interesting one, though. So if you don't mind, we digress just for a second, since we're talking about laws and regulations.
Yeah, yeah. Dive in.
First drunk driving law, I think, went into effect in New York in 1916, if I remember my history correctly.
1916?
Yeah, a really long time ago.
I didn't realize this was, okay, I wouldn't think it was a problem back then. I mean, there wasn't a lot of vehicle density, but...
Yeah, well, but there's New York. There are cars, yeah, right? So they didn't want people driving around New York City drunk and hitting horses, I guess. I don't know. So anyway, they put the law into effect. I don't know how well it was enforced back then, but... You know, that laws slowly got on the books, but they weren't, those laws weren't really enforced. It wasn't until there were a couple of the seminal things that happened in the mid 70s. First, there was a really big crash in, I believe it was Kentucky, and it was covered on the program 2020.
Okay.
Of a 3 times convicted drunk driver hitting, I think he rear ended or hit the front of a school bus. Bus caught fire, 17 kids got trapped inside and died in a fire.
Oh, that's horrific.
It was horrific. And it really got the attention of folks. And it really started pushing folks to want to enforce these laws. The other thing that happened was Candace Leitner, the founder of Mothers Against Drunk Driving, lost her teenage daughter, 13-year-old daughter, to a multiply convicted drunk driver. And she developed MAD and started to get mothers who'd also lost children holding legislators' feet to the fire. And those things really changed the conversation, and legislators started to put in tougher sanctions, requiring enforcement, doing things like breathalyzers and other sorts of things. And you saw a big change from the 70s to the 80s when after these events happened in the way in which drunk drivers are treated. If you talk to someone, maybe your father, someone who was driving back in the 60s, and say, you know, if you got drunk, pulled over drunk, what happened? They say, oh, you know, the trooper would probably say, sir, you look like you're under the weather. Let's get you home safe tonight.
Yeah.
You know, that happens now. It's like you're a member of Al-Qaeda. They're going to treat you very, very differently, and rightly so. So there's been a change in our perception and a change in enforcement. And that's actually led to a greater reduction in drunk driving over time.
Yeah. So that, you know, that's the evolution of the drunk driving laws. But, you know, we just talked about it where it's become, you know, which is scary, or it's just a fact of life. It's become very socially acceptable to use your cell phone. Well, I mean, you think about it, GPS is dependent on that.
Yeah.
Every Uber or Lyft driver who uses it, like, people are no problem with it. And then, of course, when you drive down the highway, I mean, I don't think it's hard to figure out. If you look around yourself, you're going to see plenty of people driving distracted.
Probably about 10% at any point in time. There's at least 10% of the drivers.
10%? Ah, that number seems low.
At least at any one moment in time, 1 out of 10 drivers, not 10% do it. It's at any moment in time.
Oh.
If there are 10 cars around you and you're one of them, one other person there statistically is on their phone. So
there you go. Every second you're on the road, if you say, is someone on their phone right now? 10% of people are.
Right.
That's
what they could see. Oftentimes that's an underestimate because they can't see some of the things like hands-free stuff and some other things. You know, you mentioned a few things in there. Let's continue that thread of drunk driving.
Yeah.
And then also talk about the use cases you talked about, like GPS. So a couple of things. One of the benefits of being able to enforce something like drunk driving is that you can measure someone's blood alcohol and determine if they're drunk. Even if you don't see them drinking, or even if they die at the scene of a crash, you can know if their alcohol is involved.
Yeah.
We don't have a blood alcohol test for distraction. And in fact, most people, we know this for a fact, will not admit to using a phone while driving if they get pulled over or if there's a crash. It's only when there's a forensic download of the phone by the police department, if they do that kind of thing in the state or municipality, or if there's a legal case where you actually then figure out that there's a phone use. National Safety Council said it's about 50% underreporting because they took a set of fatal crashes where they knew that a phone was involved based upon other evidence. And only about half of those listed phone as a factor in the crash. So at least 50% underreported. So one, we underestimate how prevalent it is because we can't measure it the same way we can measure drunk driving. Second thing is being drunk is sinful in the eyes of many. If you're a drunk, that's a negative connotation, right?
Yeah.
So if you drink to excess and then go and drive, you are considered to have bad judgment. Using a phone to talk, not within the context of driving, but using a phone to communicate, that's pro-social, right? You're communicating. That's a positive thing. If you don't communicate, if you withdraw and you don't want to talk to anyone, that's considered a warning sign, a risky thing. So phones are considered to be positive for the most part. So the two behaviors don't start off the same way, even though from the best research we have, drunk driving and talking on a phone hands-free or any other manner for that are equivalent in terms of risk. So they're just viewed differently because one is negative and one is positive. The other thing you mentioned, you're absolutely right. There are some things that phones will allow us to do that are necessary for the driving task. You know, so back in the day when I grew up on the roads of California, you know, I'm a little older, I had to use physical maps to navigate around.
Before you keep going, I got to tell you, I remember my dad having a map on the wheel. Like literally holding it on the wheel, trying to navigate whatever he was doing.
Yeah, and it got worse. If you were in Southern California, there's a thing called a Thomas Guide. And some people are like, oh yeah, Thomas Guides. And I remember it was a thick book. It would maybe depend on where you got it, because you only got it for certain sections. It was about 200 pages. And each page was a block of the area that you were in. And at the top, left, right, and bottom of the page, there was another page number. So if you drove off the top of the map, it would tell you what page number in your Thomas Guide you had to turn to in order to find yourself in that new section of map. So you're driving down the road, flipping through the map as you're trying to drive around.
It's like a choose your own adventure. Flip to page 43, flip back to page 21.
Right. And it sounds horrible when we say it now, right? But the thing is, you have to navigate. It's a requirement of driving. You have to know where you are and you have to know how to get to where you're going. So your dad with the map on the steering wheel, as distracting as that was, that's all he could do to actually get from point A to point B other than memorize the route, which is unrealistic for lots of folks.
Yeah.
The GPS, properly configured, reprogrammed when you're not moving, set so that you're using primarily auditory information for your turns, maybe some simple visual information that you can detect in a brief glance lasting no more than 2 seconds. Is a much safer alternative to reading a map while you're driving, using a Thomas Guide, reading a set of directions you wrote down before you got there. Yeah. Having a passenger tell you what to do when you're trying to figure out what they're telling you and they're trying to navigate. I mean, the GPS on your phone is a net positive for safety. The problem is if it suddenly becomes then a portal to using Facebook or making phone calls or sending texts, now you get a bunch of negative things along with that positive thing that you've got.
Streaming the game.
Right. And
I saw someone streaming the game. Like I forget where I was driving, but they were streaming whatever sport they were watching right on.
I
think because they were hands-free. They're like, yeah, it's hands-free. I'm good, man.
So their eyes are off the road. Their brain's off the road. And they got their hands at 10 and 2. We'll grant them that just to be kind. But yeah, their brain's not engaged with the task. They're relying on everyone around them to pay attention so that they don't get in a crash or cause a crash. Yeah. So the phone, essentially, the way it's not a phone anymore. It's a portal to the internet and all that the internet brings.
Yeah.
And the internet brings us a lot of things that we like, but that are definitely completely incompatible with safe driving and probably safety in lots of other ways too.
And so it's out of the box now. I don't see you hit on a couple things. The psychosis behind using a phone is just positive. It's not a problem. So most people are not, you know, like you said, they're not judging someone else for using the phone. Like, you just look down for just a second to, I don't know, answer a text from your kid who you're picking up. I don't know what's going on. But, you know, we've just become kind of socially accepting of it. There was an article we read that you were cited in where you predicted pre-pandemic, you actually predicted that you thought fatalities would go up, even though miles driven would go down. And that actually turned out to be true in the United States. You were cited as Or the National Safety Council cited that there's actually a 96% increase in fatality rate per mile driven.
Right.
An increase unseen in almost 100 years. Now, you predicted this.
Right.
What is it about human behavior that led you to believe that this would be true?
So it was at the beginning of the pandemic and kind of lead in the pandemic that predicted it. As we started to transition more to remote work, it became really clear that we would still do business as usual, but that we would do it in distributed ways, aided by technology, and a couple of things would happen. One, more people would be comfortable with technology. If you think pre-pandemic, how many people were really comfortable with Zoom, Teams, whatever the flavor of the interactive software?
Yeah. Now, well, its stock price like more than quadrupled during the pandemic. So,
right. Yeah. Because everyone now is using one of those things to do their work or even for their kids to go to school and do what they're doing. So we've all become a lot more comfortable with the technology. And I think one of the limiters before was that people just weren't comfortable using those technologies, period. And so they definitely weren't comfortable doing it behind the wheel. So I knew that as that comfort level went up, more people would find ways to do it in inappropriate situations, behind a wheel, in the bathroom, you know, whatever they're doing. You know?
Yeah.
So comfort level. Second thing is that it became clear as work became distributed, people would start to work less maybe in the office and they would work more at home or in other places. And then we saw the rise of Zoom towns, you know, places.
Sure.
And so I thought, okay, well, I've already been designated an expert on a couple of cases where companies were requiring their workers to attend meetings via Zoom pre-pandemic. And these folks were using their laptops while driving to give presentations on PowerPoint and gotten crashes.
That's insane.
Yeah, I know. But I knowing seeing that pre-pandemic, I thought, okay, well, this is just going to get worse because now people are going to be working in a distributed manner and they're going to be more people are going to be comfortable with the technology. And those things happened. And so the reason I predicted that fatalities specifically would go up, despite the fact that miles would go down, as we knew miles would go down because people weren't driving to work. So that was a given. That was an easy one. But the fatality increase is because you have to know something a little bit about what causes a fatal crash. Fatal crashes are crashes in which people, thinking back to Spider, you know, sensing, perceiving, interpreting, deciding, and executing a response, failed in an epic way to do one or more of those steps. Use that example of someone texting and driving down that street where your kid's playing on the sidewalk. If their nose is down looking at the phone and they're not sensing, perceiving, or any of that, they don't have a chance to even decide or execute a response. They just hit the kid and then there's a fatality, right? So that level of distraction produces a crash because they're not actually able to mitigate the crash. They're not able to execute a response to avoid the crash. So we know with distraction that what distraction does, remember going back to perception reaction time, reduces your perception reaction time by at least fourfold, even higher, that what's going to happen is you're going to see more distraction crashes, which by definition are crashes in which people typically fail to notice a hazard or execute a response to avoid the hazard. And thus you have a crash that occurs at the rate of speed that they're traveling at, yeah, or near that rate of speed,
yeah,
because they were unable to brake except at the last moment. So I knew distraction crashes would go up, and those are particularly dangerous and fatal crashes. You also see those with high rate of speed crashes. Speed has gone up. People say, well, what about speeding? Hasn't speeding gone up? That could account for it. That's true. Speeding's gone up and alcohol use while driving's gone up too. Those, of course, would also increase crash rates and fatal crashes. The thing is, though, that same pattern happened in Europe. They had fewer miles driven. They had more speeding, more drunk driving, but their distraction was lower because their laws are stronger than ours. And their fatality rates went down as their miles driven went down. So
this goes back to companies, policies, and laws. I think, like we said, cats out, you know, Pandora has left the box. This is done. Like,
you can't ignore your phone. We did that. We've done work on that. You can't ignore it.
We can't figure. We as people cannot be trusted to do the right things unless we are governed or punished. It sounds like, is that the answer? Like, we have to have harder policy, stricter policy. I guess, how does the United States, you know, I'd love to close with this. How do we get to a better outcome? Because our outcomes seem to be getting worse. I'd love for them to get better. How do they get better?
So there's never been a health crisis that's been solved through education alone. I'm speaking as an educator. I wish that was not true. I wish we could simply tell people, you know.
Modern times would suggest that is very true.
I wish we could say, look, smoking will kill you. Please stop smoking. Drinking will kill you. Please stop drinking or drink in moderation.
Yeah.
Failing to exercise will have bad outcomes for you. Please get some exercise. Lack of sleep is probably the worst thing happened to you. Could you get better sleep? And with that educational component, people would then say, oh, you're right. I need to go do those things.
Yeah, most people just ignore that. They just ignore it.
Yeah, some people will respond. You say 20% of people will respond and do something. But most of the time, for a lot of these kinds of behaviors, particularly appetitive behaviors, behaviors that involve drugs or other kind of behaviors, things like drinking, overeating, failing to exercise, which is kind of the flip side of that. Gambling is a big one. These sort of behaviors are really tough to stop with just education. So what's left in your tool bag? Well, the only thing that's really ever been effective at changing behaviors is actually directly working on the behaviors themselves. I'll use smoking as a classic example. So I grew up, old man story, I grew up in an era where everyone smoked, right? I was the first person in my family that didn't smoke. I remember as a kid, it was really annoying because you go in a restaurant, smoking section. Go on an airplane, smoking section. You know, think about it. Think about if you're behind row 20 on the airplane, that's where all the smokers were. And then forward of that, no smoking, as if the smoke doesn't travel.
I was a kid. I remember that trip. When I flew to Taiwan, so this is 1985, there was still a smoking section, which of course is the whole plane.
Right. And now we would say, that's insane. We can't do that. But people smoked. And so smoking was easy to do. It didn't cost much. Cigarettes were relatively inexpensive. It didn't affect your insurance if you smoked. So there really weren't any negative repercussions other than you would die like my grandfather did because he was a heavy smoker his entire life. So what did change the curve on smoking? Why is it fewer people smoke now in the United States in particular? Well, first off, it became really hard to do. Can't smoke in an airplane. Can't smoke in a restaurant. Can't smoke outside in certain places. Can't go to Disney World and smoke. It becomes really difficult to engage in the behavior because we put rules in place to make it hard to do. Cigarette prices went way up by design. Legislatures put huge taxes on cigarettes. So it became really expensive to engage in the behavior. And then your insurance was really expensive if you were a smoker. And your workplace didn't want you to smoke because it jacked everyone else's insurance costs up too. So we did things to specifically affect the behavior that we wanted to change, which is smoking. It wasn't education. That was still there. That was always there. But we did things to directly impact the behaviors. Same thing we talked about drunk driving. You know, the laws were there. Education was there. But it wasn't until enforcement increased that you started to see changes. So what's the answer with distracted driving? We can't educate our way out of this because we've done a lot of work on this. The phones bring us something that our brain wants.
Yep.
Information loses value quickly.
Yep.
And so when our phone goes off, we don't want to ignore because we want to know what's on it, because if we wait 10 minutes, it may not be as useful as it was when that information came in. So we got to check it right away. Our brains have gotten tuned to that. Silicon Valley's designed our phones to hijack our attention. So no education is going to overcome that. The only thing we can do is look at this highly addictive object, if we will, and say, okay, this is the cigarettes for the 21st century. What are we going to do? We're going to make it hard to use. We're going to make it, as an employee, difficult for you to use. We're going to prohibit you from using your phone in any manner, except maybe some prescribed things while you're driving a company vehicle. We're going to put some telematics on your phone to track if you use your phone while driving, so we can see if you're doing it and we can counsel you appropriately. We're going to put in some policies that will provide for corrections or penalties, including termination, if you use your phone while driving. And all of these things we're doing are designed to directly affect the behavior that we want to stop, people driving distracted. And that's what will actually reduce distraction. I will tell you, companies that do these things see a 2/3 to 3/4 reduction in crash rates in their fleets. You can take a company I know quite well, I won't mention, large company, does a lot of deliveries. Everyone recognizes them if I mention them. When they put in it's not one you're thinking of, but it's a big one.
Yeah.
But when they put in a policy prohibiting any use of a phone, including their policy said, if you have Bluetooth in, we're assuming that Bluetooth is active and you're using it with your phone. It doesn't matter because we can't see with your Bluetooth what's happening. So that's prohibitive too. And the penalty, we're putting a camera system in the vehicle that in the event of a crash or some other event will record what's happening. And if the company that does that recording sends us a video and we see Bluetooth in use, you touching your phone or talking hands-free or whatever it is, the penalty is immediate termination. No warning, you're terminated. When they put that policy in and they started enforcing it and firing folks that were violating the policy, they started to see dramatic reductions in crash rates. They had a 76% reduction in crash rates in their fleet. 76%. Think of how many fatalities were avoided.
That's unbelievable. And when you say that, I think to myself, if private automobile insurance companies started introducing the same thing, you know, they can't fire you, but they can surely control your rates.
Yeah.
They can say, hey, this is a rate of someone who doesn't want to be connected. This is price X.
Right.
Someone who is connected and let's say follows our policy, their rate might be like, you know, 1/10 of X, and they'll incentivize it through money.
We've talked to insurance companies about that very thing years ago. No one wants to pull that trigger. First off, the insurance industry is highly competitive.
Yeah.
And so they're worried that if they're the first one, they're going to bleed folks to someone else.
Everyone's going to go to a competitor. Yeah.
The other thing is you say, well, then why can't the insurance companies get together and just agree that they're going to do this? Unfortunately, in this case, insurance companies are highly regulated. They cannot, quote, collude in that manner. They can't all get together and talk about how they're going to commonly set rates. That's anti-competitive. And so even where it might be a benefit to say, as an industry, we're going to do this, they just can't do it because they can't have that conversation. So they're all stuck, you know, not wanting to be the one to lose customers. Now they do. There are some companies that will put, you know, agree to give you discounts if you agree to put in telematics on your phone.
Yep.
And other kinds of things.
State Farm does that. They offer that to me.
Yep. Right. And so they're saying, oh, we're going to put this on your phone. And part of it is don't be distracted. And if you do that, we're going to give you a 25% reduction on your auto rates. And so there are incentives that some people are doing kind of back through the back door, but no one's done the hardcore version of the other side. That might be a way to do it. Frankly, the easiest way to do it would be for states to agree to do checks of cellular records to see if someone was on a phone at the time of a crash or if the phone was in use, or to put an app on the major manufacturers that could provide police with the ability at the scene to not see privately what's happening on a phone, to just get a kind of red X or a green check that the phone was not in use or the phone was in use for something that was prohibited.
Yeah.
And that technology does exist, but it hasn't been okayed. So
that would have to be monitored at the application level though, because there's so many applications that are constantly transmitting data.
Right. You
know, listening to music is one of them, just constantly transmitting.
Right. That's what I'm saying. It had to be something that was not whitelisted.
Yeah.
You know, it was something where there was active manual use.
Yeah.
There's active video use, something like that. And then it would basically give you that red X.
Wow.
It's doable. There was a device, there was an app maker that built it, but we don't have that capability yet. So there are ways. But right now, bottom line for folks that are listening in the fleet safety world, it's the fleet safety directors who really bear the biggest responsibility for trying to do this for the employees that work for them.
Paul, thanks for being on our show today. And you shared a wealth of knowledge. And I 100% agree with you. You just cannot educate yourself into a solution. This is not a behavior anyone is going to willingly just police themselves. You're going to have to police it for them. Thanks for sharing some of that science behind that, like why we do this and how bad it can be. It was awesome having you on the show, man. Your stories and your examples, spot on. We could all relate to that.
Thank you, Albert. It was great. And I really enjoyed being here today. I really, Lacey, thanks for the invitation. And I hope all the listeners out there learned something. Thank you very much.
There you go. Thanks for joining and listening on The Fleet. The Fleet is presented by our friends at Lytics, the award-winning video telematics and fleet management solution. Trusted by more than 4,000 fleets worldwide, Lytics is the next generation of fleet technology. Help drivers address risky driving behaviors like cell phone use, speeding, and inattentive behind the wheel, all while harnessing the power of video and data to thrive in today's competitive environment. From safety to compliance to fleet tracking, Lytics technology offers the industry's most comprehensive and customizable fleet management platform. Go to lytx.com/thefleet to learn more today. That's lytx.com/thefleet.